from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Cities can get a bad rap. Crowds, air pollution, water pollution, little green space, almost no restful space. And now there's also the presumption that cities are the breeding ground for pandemics. But it's in the midst of this global pandemic that brave architects and urban planners are saying, wait a minute, cities don't have to be the dank, dirty repositories of hardship and disease. Instead, we can build cities that actually improve human health. We can design buildings that heal. We can create a built environment that's good for our bodies and our souls. So what's stopping us? This hour on Point, reimagining cities as places for better human health. Joining us today are two experts and practitioners who've thought a lot about the future of our cities. Michael Murphy joins us from Freeport, Maine. He is founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group, an architecture and design firm. The firm has worked on award-winning projects from innovative hospital designs in Haiti and Africa to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. Michael Murphy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be here.
It's great to talk with you. And so you're our architect in residence here today. And we also have an urban planner as well. Joining us from Toronto is Ken Greenberg. He's principal of Greenberg Consultants and the former director of urban design and architecture for the City of Toronto. Ken Greenberg, welcome to you.
Hello. Good to join both of you.
I'm delighted to have both of you because I'd love, you see, we're trying to set up this conversation between an expert in buildings and an expert in how all those buildings go together to make a city, to just ask this fundamental question. Can we create a built environment, a built urban environment that is actually beneficial to human health? And Michael, let me just start with you. What is your answer to that big question?
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I think the first way I'd answer that is that the built environment is always shaping our health. We often say that architecture and the built environment is never neutral. It heals or it hurts. And so that the built environment around us, the buildings we inhabit, spend 90% of our lives within, they're shaping our health in myriad different ways. And our question really has to be, how do we ensure or at least make visible the design decisions so that they're advancing positive health impacts and are taking into account the downstream effects of the design decisions that we make, and also making visible those decisions where they were creating injustices or injuries and trying to right them if we can.
Mm. So, Ken, I mean, what's your thought on that? That there's no neutrality to urban design. We're either creating environments, in Michael's words, that heal us or hurt us?
I would agree with what Michael said, and I think this runs up and down the gamut of scales, all the way from the city region to the city, to the neighborhood, to the rooms in which we all find ourselves trapped for the last 6 weeks, and how we design all of those. And what's interesting about this moment is it has shone a harsh light on all the inadequacies and in a way pointed us to the things that we could do better. And the great opportunity is to take advantage of that learning.
Yeah. So you've written about this, Ken, about, in your words, the relative poverty of our public realm. That's the harsh light that you say that's being shown by this COVID-19 pandemic. Can you give us more examples about that physical poverty that you see?
Well, since the end of World War II, in North America particularly, but around the world, we had ended up devoting more and more space in cities to the care and feeding of automobiles and shrinking sidewalks and shrinking spaces where we could be on foot, where we could be on bicycles, long before COVID-19 ever showed up. And there was a big effort to expand that space. And now what's really interesting is we're seeing with the need for physical distancing to be 2 meters or 6 feet apart, that those spaces are too small, they're too narrow. And so city after city, this is fascinating, turning on a dime, is suddenly reallocating the space in our public rights of way in favor of pedestrians and cyclists. And I'm convinced that a lot of this is going to be permanent, So from Milan to Brussels to Paris to New York to my city, Toronto, to the suburban city where I'm working, Brampton, and many others, the fact that this is happening so quickly and all of us who've been advocating for this for decades and hearing how difficult it was and the fact that we had to go so slowly, we're seeing it happen almost instantly.
Well, I'm going to come back to you on this, Ken, because I want this, the change to be permanent. I'm not quite convinced that it could be, but hold that thought here, because Michael, reflect on what Ken is saying about that relative poverty of our public realm. How do you see that in terms of just the way that the buildings that we enter and live in are designed?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I think one of the ways we might describe that, let's say, relative poverty is that a lot of our built world and the public realm in which we inhabit, be it, you know, the street or, let's say, the lobby of the building, have not been designed, maybe very specifically, in consideration of our own physical health. And maybe they're designed to expedite movement of people or to ensure, let's say, a successful restaurant and seating, but it's not necessarily designed around our health all the time and consideration of the air and the light and the movement of air within those spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think right now what we're seeing, all of us hunkered down in our homes, is an incredible paradigm shift in our own spatial literacy, our own spatial awareness that the built structures around us have the ability to injure us, can be in contaminated spaces, or potentially protect us against contaminated spaces. And that awareness is a real awakening, I think, to what might be the way we evaluate and demand our built world to change in the future.
Mm. You know how Ken gave us the example of how for, 50, 60, 70 years, we've had cities designed at the macro level around the care and feeding of the automobile, which is the phrase I just love, Ken. Do we see the same an analogous design presumption at the level of individual buildings? I mean, you talked about the movement of air, Michael. Are there certain things that just go without saying now in terms of how we build buildings that might actually make the air less healthy for us inside those buildings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the most fundamental shifts in the built environment of the last 60 to 70 years, along with the automobile, is the introduction of mechanical systems to move air through buildings. And while those mechanical systems, HVAC, air conditioning, have of course allowed us to inhabit environments which are less appealing to people without them, and create really unique architectural ideas like ski slopes in the desert outside of Dubai, the question we have to ask is should we be doing that? And can we be rethinking the way buildings used to be designed based on the climate around them to have airflow, natural ventilation, passive systems, and the movement of natural air through our buildings, our hospitals, our schools, as not only a mitigation strategy, but also to reconnect us to the climate around us? If we take that shift, the architecture itself has to change as well. It can't be the same building you would build in one city versus another in a very different climate. It has to be very specific and very regionally based.
Mm. Michael, can you give us an example of what you're talking about? Because I'll be honest, I'm talking to you from a Northeast city where part of the reason why buildings are sealed up the way they are has to do with heat and the and winter, and then also heat in the summer. So what does a sort of differently ventilated building look like, and how do you achieve that?
Well, you can look to the vernaculars of our region. I mean, in the Northeast, we have low ceilings in order to heat in the winter, and then windows that opened to get cross ventilation in the summer. If you go and look at the vernacular buildings of New Orleans, for example, which had high ceilings so that heat would rise, and large windows that could open in the kind of more humid time of the year to get a lot of airflow through, you're reminded that buildings used to be designed very specifically for their microclimates and their context. And that changed in the mid-century when we could really control the interior climate and air conditioning and then really hermetically seal the buildings themselves. And while that, of course, that leads to some innovations that won't change, it's a reminder that we've really disaggregated our built environment from the places and the context in which we are in. And I think that now has an opportunity to change, remind us that we are living within a certain building, within a certain climate that needs to breathe, regardless of whether we can open or close the windows, which is becoming evident to a lot of people that they can't open their windows in hospitals, for example, which is a real problem right now.
Wow. Ken, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I just want to first say that a lot of the things that Michael is talking about that make buildings healthier are also, and this is really the interesting thing, they make us more able to deal with the next great, and one might argue even greater challenge, which is climate change. Mm-hmm. And so rather than these things being in conflict, we often see dealing with climate change and the economy positioned as choices. Well, in fact, I think what this pandemic is showing us is that this is actually a dress rehearsal for dealing with that much greater collective challenge across the planet. So we can explore that a little bit. But I wanted to say that another thing that I want to bring into the conversation right away is something that has been revealed is incredible inequities in our society and who is being affected most by this. And we're seeing that in Canada in long-term care, particularly nursing homes, where our seniors are turning out to be incredibly vulnerable. We're seeing it in neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I'm going to just jump in here for a quick second and forgive me, but it's only because we have to take a break. We have a lot more to discuss about how we can design buildings and cities that are actually beneficial for human health, that heal. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're asking this hour whether the COVID-19 pandemic and the crisis of this pandemic is actually shining a light on the idea that we can and should be creating built environments, cities that heal. And to help us through this conversation, we're joined today by Ken Greenberg. He's principal of Greenberg Consultants and former director of urban design and architecture for the City of Toronto. Michael Murphy also joins us. He's founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group, an award-winning architecture and design firm. And Ken, before the break, you were talking about the inequities that have been revealed in almost every imaginable sector, including our built environment, revealed by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I wanted to let you complete your thought on that.
Sure. Malcolm Gladwell, in giving a talk recently, came up with a great analogy, and that is if you're coaching a soccer team, what you want to do is focus on your worst player, not your best player, because it's a team sport. Helsinki brags that it has the best worst schools of all cities on the planet. And I think what we're seeing is that it's not in terms of healthcare having extraordinarily complicated, exotic medicine for a small percentage of the population that makes us safe in the advent of a pandemic. It's public health, and it's how everybody is treated. And so I think whether it's the way we think about housing, which and affordability of housing, or anything else, this is really an issue. Jane Jacobs, when she wrote Death and Life in Great American Cities, made a really powerful distinction between density and overcrowding.
Right.
And overcrowding is what gave rise to disease and to epidemics. And so this kind of demonizing of the city, saying it's the density, it's the fact that we all live together is causing the problem, is kind of missing the point. It's how we build cities, how we build together from the neighborhood to the individual building, to the agglomeration of neighborhoods, and building in generosity. There's a term that's often used in construction called value engineering, which means taking out the fat in order to save money. And I'm arguing these days that we have to value in redundancy, multiple ways of doing things, and generosity in the fabric of our neighborhoods, in our buildings. And this goes to some of the spaces that Michael was talking about within buildings, because that redundancy gives us a way of pivoting in a case like what we're living through now, in order to do the things we had to do anyway, whether it's getting our food or getting around the city or interacting with other people in multiple ways.
Right.
Not finding that we're trapped because there's only one way of doing something.
Right, because the redundancy allows for responsiveness, is what you're saying. Now, look, Michael, I'm a very visual learner, and so I spent some time yesterday looking through some of the designs and projects that Mass Design Group has engaged in over the past many years. I mean, just sticking with the healthcare and hospital space for just a moment, Can you walk us through, say, one of the hospital projects that Mass Design Group has worked on in Haiti or other places that can sort of describe to us what this different approach, this building in generosity that Ken was talking about in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we really began our work after I met the amazing Dr. Paul Farmer when I was a graduate student in architecture, and he was working in places like Haiti, Rwanda, Malawi, and they were building hospitals in service of the communities most in need, those most underserved, the most rural, but they were working with buildings that were not designed to deal with epidemics, in this case, like airborne diseases like tuberculosis or multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. And so the design challenge there was, how do we repurpose existing buildings to make them less infectious? How do we design them against epidemics as they're changing currently? And there were very simple strategies, which were, again, back to increasing air, operating the flows of patients and staff, and then really thinking very, very carefully about the microclimate and regional conditions in which the building exists. And one of the main reasons for that was working in this case, rural northern Rwanda, we didn't necessarily have access to large-scale mechanical ventilation systems, of which we rely on in the United States, nor do we have access to, let's say, the entire field of mechanical engineers to fix and maintain them. And so you had to think back to the way in which we built medical facilities or old TB sanatoria in the 30s and the 20s. And it really kind of broke open an understanding of the built environment that has always been, to some degree, designed in response to health conditions. And when you ask it from that perspective, you see that there were these moments of time where epidemics shaped the design of cities over and over again. The sanitation era of the 1860s to the 1880s was driven by the response to cholera as it kind of ravaged cities across the globe. Central Park is designed as a way to introduce light and air and public space to kind of heal the city in that era. Water systems that are developed as a response to cholera's outbreak in London are all changed the way that cities are built, and they're all in response to kind of epidemic crisis. So we see these relationships as always being intertwined or inextricably linked, and our kind of question is, how do the buildings and the built environment directly respond to those epidemics as they're changing?
Right. You know, in some of the hospitals that you worked on, there's elegant and simple solutions like putting hallways outside, for example, or at least exposed to the outdoors for the air circulation, as you're talking about, sunlight, things like that. I mean, I feel like simple ideas can go a really long way here. But Michael and Ken, hang on for a second, because this has touched a nerve amongst our listeners. So let's go to Owen, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Owen, you're on the air.
How are you? And old Frederick Law Olmsted, Buffalo, New York, is a major beneficiary of his vision. We have lots of green space. But the modern trend, economic pressure from the developers, is to rebuild our tax base. The government, unfortunately, is knuckling under this pressure as well, to create a new urban slum tenement situation with density, density, density. I understand the economic pressure to maximize rent incomes. But the other thing, I embrace diversity, and that's a wonderful thing. We have mixed housing, mixed neighborhoods that are affordable. There's the idea of a micro house so that you could still have green space on your property.
Mm-hmm.
But these huge projects of multiples, we mentioned someone from Toronto. I feel we're being invaded and getting this economic pressure from the Canadians to do what they've, the mistakes they made on the waterfront in Ontario, to build these massive high-density skyscrapers that block out the view and limit public access to the waterfront, but also natural light.
Houses that
have, I enjoy, in my single-family home, I enjoy natural light on all four sides. And I have friends that live in condos. They have a little light, one little window that face the street. It's like living in a cave.
Yeah. So, Owen, you've brought up a really very important point in this conversation, and I want to let Ken Greenberg, who is our guest joining us from Toronto, to engage with this idea. Because, Ken, I mean, we talked about density versus crowding, but respond to Owen's concerns here about the economic pressures leading to a particular kind of density, which may not be good for individual health or even community health.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to Frederick Law Olmsted because he's come up twice in the conversation already. And people may not know that although he's considered one of the founders of the contemporary practice of landscape architecture, he started off as an abolitionist during the Civil War, and his background was in public health. And that's really what inspired him to create Central Park. But I think the caller is raising a really important issue, and it goes back to this issue of generosity of, I would call it, the public realm. And not only is it healthy in terms of the ability to be in fresh air, to exercise your body, but for social cohesion, which turns out to be one of the key factors of resiliency in a society in times of crisis, it's extremely important. We need those places where we connect with each other, where we know each other, and where we can fall back on each other. And in 1995 in Chicago, there was a famous heat wave. And one of the really interesting discoveries was that in the neighborhoods that had a strong social structure, so that people looked in on each other, they checked out how seniors were doing, for example, during the heat wave. The number of people who died as a result of the heat wave was much lower than in neighborhoods where people were relatively disconnected, alienated, fragmented. And so I think this has put an enormous new focus again on a failing, which was the loss of that generosity in the public realm. And so one of the concepts that I work with a lot these days is the idea of the 20-minute neighborhood, which is anchored by a community hub with school, library, community center, daycare, local shopping, all the things that people do in the course of their daily lives, so that you have the opportunity to build that social cohesion, which is so critical in moments like the one we're experiencing.
Yeah. So, Ken, if I might drill down a little bit more into what Owen was saying, because density... It's not just density versus crowding, two different ways of looking at bringing more people within a square mile, for example. But he was also talking about that there are financial structures, zoning laws that are helping to foster these big big new buildings that have lots of units in them. I mean, he was calling them basically new tenements. And look, in some American cities in particular, when the cost of housing is rising ever higher, one of the solutions has been, let's build more. Let's build more apartments, more densely populated neighborhoods. And so I think Owen was questioning the downside of that. So how can we build more while also at the same time factoring in all the things that you just talked about regarding like the 20-minute neighborhood? I mean, do we have the legal structure for that, Ken?
Yeah, so I'm co-founder of something called the City Building Institute at Ryerson University. We've just put out a report called Density Done Right. And the point is that not density, just doing clusters of very high buildings all together is not the answer. The answer is distributed density. And we're looking at the entire city region of Toronto. We're going to grow from about 6.5 million to 13.5 million by 2041. So where are all these people going to go? And what we're arguing, or that what that report argues, is that there are tremendous opportunities which would be beneficial of going for what's called the missing middle in scale between the single family home and the 40-story tower. There's a whole range of building types, everything from laneway housing, what you would call alley housing, to introducing extra units within single family neighborhoods, to small scale apartment buildings on our main streets. And that really should be the focus. And that benefits a lot of neighborhoods that gain from having that additional population and that diversity and the services that come with it. But I think we've fallen into a trap, and I think your caller has a point, that we've been concentrating the density in too few places. There's an enormous need for additional housing, and it's produced hyper-density, which is probably not the best way to do it.
Right. And then Michael Murphy, even in the best of cases where, you know, new buildings are approved, for example, it seems to me that the other aspects of life around those buildings, the green spaces, the open spaces, the schools, the transportation, come as almost as an afterthought. That to me is also part of the problem here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think one of the other things the caller is talking about is that the type of development that we've seen in our cities, especially in the United States over the course of the last 50 years, has been largely market-driven development, where federal investments in infrastructure have been increasingly diminished every generation. And what we may see coming through in the next couple of years is another potential great New Deal or a great society or another great investment in urban infrastructure and even rural infrastructure. And what form will that take? And what values will it be driven by? And what protocols will be in place to ensure that it's serving those most in need, that it's creating healthier environments, that it's investing in local resources? These are the questions that I think we have now to ask. Because those experiences of the past, you know, the Great Depression or the Great Society, give us a kind of a pathway or a map to see what the future infrastructure we might invest in could look like.
So
Meghna, can I just jump in to
please,
add
go
something
ahead.
To what Michael said? You may or may not know it, but I served as interim chief planner in Boston, where you are, for a couple of years.
Oh, I know, Ken.
During the period of the Big Dig. And the infrastructure that Michael is talking about, which will be essential in dealing with sea level rise in a city like Boston and figuring out how to protect the city, is also going to produce a whole new set of public spaces. And so landscape urbanism, which is now a very current term, will both have to deal with the issue of vulnerability to climate change or sea level rise, but it can be harnessed to expand the public realm along our seafronts and waterfronts, adding to that social resiliency that I was speaking about in a moment. And so this multi-solving, instead of solving one problem at a time, but addressing multiple problems through creative design I think is the greatest opportunity before us now.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more, because in ideally, resilient cities, resiliency writ large, allows for that longer term sustainability and the shorter term responsiveness that we would need around the kinds of emergencies we're all experiencing right now. So there's a lot more to talk about regarding what COVID-19 is teaching us about our built environment. So Ken Greenberg and Michael Murphy, stand by for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking about cities and any urban spaces, any human-built space, in fact, and how we can design those spaces for the betterment of public health. I'm joined today by Ken Greenberg. He's principal of Greenberg Consultants, with us from Toronto, Canada. Michael Murphy is also with us. He's founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group, an award-winning architecture and design firm. And let's go back to our listeners. Let's go to Christopher, who's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi there, Meghna.
Hi.
I'm always disappointed by these conversations because they never include a landscape architect.
Out of fairness, Frederick Law Olmsted just got at least two shout-outs, Christopher.
But there isn't a landscape architect at the table. You're talking about landscape architecture, but there isn't the professional to represent the field at the table. And you're using words like open space and green space. There isn't any such thing as open space. It's a park. It's, you know, a plaza. Giving it a name, giving it some sense of identity is helpful. So,
well, pull up a chair. Am I going to? Is it safe for me to presume that you are you a landscape architect?
I am.
Okay, so pull up a chair to the table, then, Christopher. How do you see landscape architecture being a central and important part of designing these more responsive and resilient cities that we're talking about?
Well, you touched on it a little bit with rising sea level. The importance of landscape architects is going to become even more important as we tackle that problem. But even, you know, the fundamental experience of a city is landscape. It's not, you can go into your building, but experiencing the city is experiencing it on the street, mm-hmm. or in a park or in a plaza. It's not the parsley around the pig. It's really what binds the city together at a human scale.
Completely agree. And that's why I was saying earlier that I feel that it's unfortunate that in many cases, and say when a neighborhood's being built up, exactly what you're talking about, Christopher, isn't the first thought. It's the second or third one, really, after all the permits have been issued, really. But Christopher, thank you so much for your call. Michael Murphy, did you want to respond to what Christopher was saying?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, we definitely, in our own firm, we have landscape architecture and do a number of landscape projects. We see urban design, landscape, and architecture really intertwining in so many different ways under these most fundamental questions. And, you know, that question for us is, how does the built environment that includes buildings, landscapes, and the urban design around us, how do they allow us to heal? How do they keep us healthy? And I think we have to think about healing in really three scales. There's the healing of the body. You know, can a building, we're feeling that right now. Can the space make us sick or keep us safe? There's the healing of our community. Ken talked about social cohesion as a metric we might talk about that measures the health of a community or of a greater body of people. And then there's also the healing of our nation under crucial questions of, say, national trauma. You know, and that's where I see the role of monuments and markers mm-hmm. and memorials really is an important investment that we're going to be making. I mean, people dying of COVID, I mean, the trauma, the loss of life that we're not even dealing with right now is just going to be this ongoing challenge that we're faced with as a nation to wrestle with this historic loss of life. And we're going to be seeing, I think, the emergence of new types of public monuments, digital monuments, testimonials, and places for people to grieve where they weren't able to grieve and to really pay tribute to the loss of life that we've seen because of this epidemic.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. One of the ways to improve urban design would be to have better public transportation.
Absolutely.
Omaha has just buses, which are not very full. And I'm wondering how a smaller city like Omaha can actually improve their public transportation when there seem to be financially infeasible.
Yeah. Jim, thank you for that question. And Ken Greenberg, Jim's question allows us to return to this issue of, as you said, the generation-long building of cities around the care and feeding of automobiles. And I think Jim is right. Like, we cannot have a solution or a vision for a new and more resilient urban space without better transit. So this is a question worth hours and hours of conversation. But how do we get there if we have to move away from the automobile-centric model of cities? How do we do that?
Well, the counterpart to the reliance on the car has been the separation of where we live from where we work, from where we shop, from where we go to school, which causes a whole host of problems. And I think what we're trying to do is put the fragments of the city back together in those 20-minute or 15-minute neighborhoods so that people have access to all those things in proximity and access to each other. So I see this as the pandemic is giving us the impetus to piggyback a new urgency on something that we were trying to do already. And there will be a wave of stimulus funding that's certainly coming in Canada and coming in the U.S. And the question is, how do we use that stimulus funding to do these things that needed doing, like improving ways of getting around the city, like adding that redundancy? But I want to go back to something you said earlier, Meghna, about whether the pilots, whether these probes will survive. And I want to quote a book that I'm sure Michael knows by somebody called Stuart Brandt. It's How Buildings Learn. And it applies also to how cities learn. They learn by failure, by things that don't work, that need to be fixed. And I think if we look around now at all the innovative things that people are doing in this moment of crisis, and we harvest those. So, for example, tremendous interest now in people growing their own food, seed banks. Looking at tenuous supply chains and doing making things closer to home. We're suddenly finding a way to get homeless people off the streets and into hotel rooms and into vacant buildings. All the efforts at transforming streets or spaces in the rights of way. I think there are a lot of things which, if we look carefully about how we are adapting in a moment of a kind of stress test, trying to hustle to deal with failures very quickly and the incredible ability of civil society in many cases with strong leadership coming from government. I want to stress that. I've never seen such across-the-board multi-party collaboration as we're seeing in Canada now around dealing with these things. But I think when you put all that together, there's a tremendous learning that we can take advantage of.
Well, so Michael earlier had talked about Central Park or London's sort of water systems after cholera epidemics there. Regarding changes in transportation, are there examples going on right now, Ken, that you would point to as ones that we could learn from?
Well, all the major cities in the world have been busy trying to make the shift from auto dependence, led by, for example, cities like Amsterdam and Copenhagen, and in South America, Bogota, and a whole variety of others, London, Paris, New York. But what's happened is the acceleration, the phenomenal acceleration of all those efforts. And as I said before, I firmly believe, well, I believe two things. One is we're not all going to want to retreat into our computers in a virtual world. Mm-hmm. We're going to want to go back to in real life and connect with each other. And we're going to want the spaces to do that. And I think we're not going to give that space all back to the car so quickly. I think there will be a permanent legacy from this period, which is going to go on until we have a vaccine. There's going to be some time while we're living differently and we're gradually coming back into public space. But I see that as a tremendous opportunity to make a shift that was needed in any case.
Yeah, I mean, it, as you've written, can you call it a possible reallocation of space, right, for public use and not prioritizing vehicular traffic and cramping pedestrians and creating a more expansive network of public spaces to uncrowd our cities? Let's hope that indeed that happens. Michael Murphy, we've got about 2 minutes left here. I'm wondering if you see also other changes that have been catalyzed by the COVID crisis that could actually persist, that could stay with us in terms of how we build new buildings or change our cities.
Yeah, I do. I think what we're facing right now and realizing each individually is a real culture change, a culture change about how we understand the impact of the built environment on our lives. And that, I think, is going to force or could force what we might call a new regionalism in the context in which we live, and meaning that the decisions that we make about our built environment, the materials that we choose, the labor that's building it, the impact it has on the climate and the microclimate around us, all are regionally impacting us and are integrated with our own health. I think of the slow food movement as a good analog for us to think about where the built environment needs to go. We might call the slow space movement, which is how do we think about every design decision as being impactful to our lives and to our community, and making much more purposeful decisions about who builds, what materials we choose, and then measuring the impact they have on our lives and our communities.
Well, let's hope so. Michael Murphy is founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group, an award-winning architecture and design firm. They've worked on everything from hospitals in Haiti and Africa to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. I mean, a spectacular example of social healing brought about through architecture. Michael Murphy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna.
And Ken Greenberg, principal of Greenberg Consultants and former director of urban design and architecture for the City of Toronto. Ken, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Pleasure.
So we've been talking about changes that the COVID-19 pandemic might bring about at the levels of buildings or even cities. What about something smaller, like signs and notices? Well, designers are already thinking about how to reimagine street signs and notices that advise the public on how to stay safe and healthy amid the outbreak.
What's universal around design right now and the way we're looking at it is this idea of compassion and connection.
That's Dylan Coonrad, creative director at the global design firm Canon Design. He's reimagined 10 signs that we may be familiar with. The project is conceptual and often witty. For example, a fire extinguisher sign that now says, "Don't hoard sanitizer," or a national park sign that has a leaf wearing a mask. Dylan says, great design must be empathetic.
So for us, it's perfectly okay to show up to a problem without the answers, but instead show up with vulnerability and energy and curiosity to figure it out. And that takes guts. But it's something that designers have perfected, and I think it's really valuable now.
And Dylan told us even more about the project.
When I was going on a run down in Brooklyn, I don't go on runs often. I ran track in high school. I told myself I would retire my body from running. So when I do run, I pay attention to everything else just to get my mind off of it. And for some reason, I was looking at these signs along the way, and there was one in particular that caught my attention. It was the pedestrian crossing one. And it seemed to me it was just misleading in this day and age with the man and the woman being so close crossing the street on the sign. And I thought, no matter what language you speak, no matter where you come from, no matter where you live, we all rely on these universal signs to tell us how to act and how to behave. And most importantly, how to stay safe. And if there's one thing we need right now, it's that constant reminder to stay safe and healthy. So these signs act as that great unifier. And by the time I got home from the run, I had a handful of ideas already. In the sign, there's two people crossing, a man and a woman. They kind of overlap their bodies. And in this solution, they took those same exact people and just moved them apart to demonstrate that it doesn't take much for us to change our behavior, but it goes a long way. If anyone's walked past a wet floor, they've seen those almost table tent-like signs. The new version of that replaced the slipping man in midair almost and changed it, that same man shape, but raised his arm in celebration and asked everyone to, instead of caution, slippery and wet, it said, celebrate healthcare workers. So people pay attention to those signs, I think, more than most. And putting a positive message on that was a really great connection for us. It was powerful to be able to take these universally recognized elements and put a certain angle on them that would make people notice or take a double take. And I think when people read them, I hope they would think there's someone out there that appreciates my well-being and they care about what I do. And that's what I want to tell everyone, that we're in it together, there's hope, and there's light at the end of the tunnel. I also want to celebrate the designers of the past who actually developed these amazing social communication tools, because they've become so critical to how we act. They're remarkable pieces of design. They're not sold on shelves and they're not hanging in museums, but they mean everything to us. And I think we rely on them more than we might realize.
Dylan Coonrad, Canon Design Creative Director. He spoke with us from his home in Brooklyn, New York. And to see some of the signs Dylan has been talking about, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amada, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.